Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Question Reality with Priscilla Leona, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Your host, Priscilla Leona, and we are coming to you live from Los Angeles, California. Our show is broadcast every Sunday from 5 p.m. to 5:50 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. If this is your first time tuning in, our show will help you to question your career reality. This show is for you if you are considering a career in the entertainment industry. Our guests will provide you with tips, advice, and resource information on how and what it takes to successfully pursue a career in show business. Our guests work in various professions and are at different stages of their career. So that means that we will definitely have someone on the show that will be able to help you with your show business career questions. If you want to check out our past guests, read their bios, listen to their interview instantly, or download one of the shows, go to the LA Talk Radio website, and that is latalkradio.com. latalkradio.com, and you click on the link at the top of the website that says Channel 1, scroll down and look for our show, which is Question Reality, of course, and you click this link, and this takes you directly to our archive page, and that is where you can view the list of the past guests. Now, you can also download our free app for your Android or iPhone and listen to any of the other exciting and informative shows that we have. Just download the app from our homepage on the LA Talk Radio website, and that icon is down. It's located down, like towards the bottom of the page. So you just got to scroll a little bit, but you'll see it. Now, our shows are also available for download on iTunes under the podcast section and also on Stitcher.com. So just go to their websites and type Question Reality Radio in the search box, and there you are. You're going to find us. And if you want to find out about our future guests, now that's a whole different website that you have to go to. That is our official Question Reality Radio show website. Now, that address is Question Reality Radio. Show.com. Question Reality Radio Show.com, and that will have a list of all of the guests. And we book per season. We're usually booked 6 months to a year in advance. So if you know of anyone who works professionally in the entertainment industry and would like to come on and promote their project or talk about their work, and they are, again, they work professionally, refer them to our website, Question Reality Radio Show.com, and tell them to submit via our contact page and just include a little bio and why they would like to come on the show and how they could help provide some great career advice to our audience. So, as usual, we have a fantastic guest for you today. His name is, and I pray I don't butcher this his name, because I'm telling you, there's a lot of E's in this name. There's like E, 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 E. Okay, so I'm going to give it a whack. His name is Dennis D. Fahili, and he is a writer, public speaker, and a communication expert. And Lord knows, we need a communication expert on this show. Now, he was referred to me by a lovely, lovely, lovely friend of mine. I adore her. She is wonderful. Wonderful. She's one of my favorite friends in the whole world. She's also a fellow Scorpion. Her name is Leanne Hamilton, and she just told me how wonderful her cousin was, who happens to be our guest today, Dennis, and that he wrote this fantastic book, that he was a travel writer, again, among other things. And I said, I have to have him on the show. Now, Dennis Fahili is a noted communication expert and author of a top-selling travel book, and it's called Traveling Man Across the Sahara and Beyond. And it's a story of a 3,000-mile journey as a 19-year-old, which will also include hitchhiking like 1,000 miles across the Sahara Desert, which I can't even imagine the adventures that he got into. But we're going to hear about a couple of them. And Dennis is in-demand public speaker with speaking engagements and seminars in the United States and also abroad. He's appeared on many television and radio shows to discuss his travels of 50 countries around the world. And some of his adventures included rugged, like manly man travel to 30 countries by the age of 21. Oh my God, I was just waiting to get my damn license to get into the nightclub at 21. That was like my big adventure, traveling from my house to the nightclub. And boy, he had done over 30 countries. He lived a much more exciting life than I did, for God's sakes. And he did all this while he was studying and playing rugby at Oxford University. La da, tootie tata, Oxford University. Oh my God, I lived in England for 6 months, nowhere near Oxford, but that's about as far as I traveled. And as everybody knows, because I've been complaining about it for the whole 8 years I've been on the show, my husband, who is a world traveler against his will from his family, he's lived all over the world. And he said, you know what? When you've seen one tree, you've seen them all. When you've seen one, that is his philosophy, which I don't share. So I said, you know what? I am saving up for a trip to Prague and I'm going without you. And if I meet a hot guy, well, I'll send you the divorce papers because I'm traveling to Prague, by God. Anyway, Dennis is one of the few Americans to travel. Now, this is very, very interesting, highly exciting to me, and I want to talk about this in depth. He is one of the few Americans to travel unrestricted behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. Oh, my gosh. What did he get into? I just can't wait to hear. And just a little bit about him before all of these adventures happened. He, prior to being a writer and a public speaker, he worked on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. as a legislative correspondent. And he was also the founder and CEO of Primex International Trade Corp. So I think I might be intimidated by him now. I don't even know what to talk to him about. I have no idea. I'm just going to wing these little primary base questions at him and hope that he dumbs down to answer them for my show. So without further ado, let's just talk to him now. Dennis, welcome to the show. Thank you for gracing us with your presence.
Hey, Priscilla. It's great to be here. Appreciate it.
My God, what in the hell is going on with you? You're like a man about town. You're what's as in the what was his name? You are what's called a continental dude, an international traveler. You are a man about town. I don't even know what you look like, but I picture you looking like, because we're doing the show remote. I picture you looking like a combination of Clark Gable and Cary Grant. That's what I see. Now you, your latest book is a travel memoir from a trip that you took over 30 years ago when you were 19. And from what I understand, the trip started in London, and it was interesting what came next, because it said the trip started in London where I met my brother. So I don't know if he's a long lost brother or you and your brother just said, you know what, we got $175, let's go travel across Europe. So I know that your original plan was to travel across Western Europe to Africa and then cross the Sahara and Northern Africa and then go back to London. Yes. right? And then from what I understand, you traveled 40 days, 3,000 miles across two continents. You hitchhiked 1,000 miles across the Sahara. You had cross by ship. My God, you were stowaways across the Mediterranean Sea on $6 a day. I think we spend $6 a day on a coffee now. How you lived on that, I don't know. And then what's more exciting, we're going to break this down. I'm just giving bullet points. But you got lost. You guys got lost in the Sahara and blocked by the sub-Saharan war. And you had to bribe your way past the guerrillas, and you ran out of money in Morocco, and the only way you got back to us, brought Dennis back, was from the kindness of a stranger. So, first of all, let's start out with, what was the motivation for you and your brother to travel across the Sahara Desert in the first place? At 19,
well,
I don't know who thinks about that.
Old.
I mean, you weren't even thinking about going to the club, meeting a girl, getting a car. You were too progressive for the rest of us. What was the motivation, Dennis?
When I was a young age, I just had this real passion to see the world and explore the world, you know, and this was 30 years ago, so the world was much more of a mysterious place. There was no internet or cell phones or fax machines, and when I finished high school, I'm from Michigan. I planned to go to Michigan State University, but I just had this real desire and this passion to see the world, and I knew I was young, this is my time, so I canceled going to Michigan State University, and I found this program in England at Harlaxton College, and I planned to go there for 1 year, do some traveling, and then come back to Michigan State. Well, while I was at Harlaxton, I hitchhiked down to Oxford University, found an overseas study program there, applied to that, got accepted. So I went back 2 more years at Oxford and played rugby there. So I was 3 years in England at a very young age. And during that time, I did a lot of traveling. I traveled over 30 countries, Europe, Africa, the Middle East, while going to school. And I paid for it myself. It was very, very difficult and traveled very cheaply. But it was a great experience for me.
Wow. My God. Now, 40 years later or 30 years later, why did you decide to write your book at this particular time? Like, why didn't you write it right after you came back? Why now?
That's a good question. It was kind of, I had all these unique travel experiences in the Sahara, behind the Iron Curtain, a very unusual experience. And I tell people the story sometime about what I did, and almost everybody would say, Dennis, you should write a book about that. And then finally, I lived in Asia for many years, and I told the same one of my stories to the Korean professors that I worked with. They don't speak very good English. And they all said, Dennis, you should write a book about that. So I finally decided one day I'll sit down and write a book. And that's what I did. I just finally decided it was time. I kind of wish I started earlier.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Everybody's like, write a book, write a book, write a book. Oh, okay, I'll write a book. Now, what was it like? Take us there. Take us on a vivid journey, if you will, of what it was like as a 19-year-old getting lost in a war zone and running out of money in the Sahara Desert. Can you take us there on a journey in a writer's way?
Sure. We started, in London, and we were supposed to have $700, $175. We decided to go for it. So we hitchhiked, snuck on trains all across Western Europe. Then we snuck on a ship. We were stowaways across the Mediterranean Sea to Tunisia. From Tunisia, our plan was to travel along the coastal route, kind of an easy route. But we got to the Tunisian-Algerian border, which is a very desolate border. It's nothing but Sahara. We had to hire a man with a jeep to drive us out to the border. He drops us off. All there was one little border post building in Tunisia. You go about a quarter mile down the road, the one highway. There's another building, and that's Algeria. It's all desert, every direction as far as you can see. So we tried to cross the border the first time. We were blocked. We couldn't get through without a visa. We had to backtrack. We came back the next day with a visa, and there's these real rugged soldiers there, not very friendly. We didn't feel very safe at the border, but they stamped us, allowing us to exit Tunisia and now enter Algeria. But now we're at the border post. It's at night. It's in the middle of the Sahara. And we think the nearest town from the border is about 40 miles. We asked them, the soldiers at the border post, is there transportation to the nearest town? They say, no, not for 3 days. So I'm like, no way. I'm sitting here for 3 days, this border post with all these soldiers and guns and so forth. So we decided to walk it. So we started walking out in the Sahara at night with no water, no food, no map, thinking we have to walk 40 miles along the highway to get to the first town. Well, it turned out to be 80 miles to the first town. And yeah, it was something. And while we're walking, we walked about 6-7 hours, complete black darkness. Had a real strange thing happen along the walk.
No flashlight at all? You didn't even know about this? I know out in that desert they've got those sand snakes.
Oh, they do. I was worried about that because when we were walking, we could not see the pavement of the road, and it kind of felt the same as the hard rock of the desert. So we'd have to reach down sometime, make sure we're still walking on the road, not out into the desert. And I was always nervous about snakes being down there when I touched the road, you know. But it was very dark, and there was no stars that night, very cloudy night. And we walked about 7 hours, and finally we saw these two lights coming from behind us from the border. It turned out to be a car. So there's nowhere to hide. We just stood by the road, and the car pulled up. And it was a soldier from the border. This big guy had a rifle, had a pistol. He tells us to get in the car. He didn't ask us. He tells us. So we get in the car, and we say, oh, shukran, thank you, sahab, thank you, friend, thank you. We'll go to the first town. He drives off to the desert of the first town, but he doesn't let us out of the car. He turns dead south into the Sahara. We want to go north. And he drove us all night long for about 7-8 hours through three little towns and through the desert. And then that ride set us off in this incredible adventure. Because we reached a point we thought we'd be too far going back. We'll keep going forward. And
while you're in the car, you obviously know that this guy is taking you in the direction you don't want to go. Why didn't you jump out and like make a run for it? Were you guys too scared? Or were you of the adventurous mind like, okay, well, if he's taking us to a death camp, you know, maybe we got a joint in our pocket. We could just get high and like go with it. What was your thoughts with this guy driving you? He didn't talk to you at all and communicate where he was taking you? Well, how could you just sit there?
Well, we had really no choice. You know, I was in the back seat, my brother's in the front seat. When we hitchhiked, one guy would always sleep, the other guy would rest, and then we changed when we were in the car. When he started south in the Sahara, there's no way to get out. Number one, he never stopped. There's only three villages, so we're always moving. And then second, out there in the desert, there's nowhere to hide. I mean, the desert is open for miles and miles and miles, so even if we jumped out of the moving car, all he had to do was stop, turn the lights on us, and follow us in the desert, and we're going to do shoot us or something, you know. So we just stayed in the car.
He was armed. He had guns.
Yeah, he had a rifle and a pistol in the car. He's a big guy, and he wasn't threatening us. He was just quiet and just determined to drive and didn't say anything to us. He kept driving. What it turned out to be is he wanted to trade black market with us for our money,
which we did with him.
Trade black market, which I did a lot of my travels sometimes. And in Algeria at that time, their money's not good outside the country. So people living in the country always want to get Western currency, American dollars especially. And they'll trade for you much higher than the bank.
So would it be safe to say he kind of like kidnapped you and wanted your money and stuff? Is that?
I guess so. I guess he wanted us in the car for the ride. You know, we didn't really know. And he never told us. He finally stopped after about 8 hours outside this one little village, and then he started gesturing about trading money with him. So I talked to my brother, well, I guess we better. He's got a rifle. So we started negotiating in the car with him, you know, for our American dollars for his currency. And we wanted to make a lot of money, so we held kind of tough. And we're in that little car, in the heat of that little cramped car for an hour, negotiating back and forth. Finally, he got really angry, just opened the door, threw my brother's backpack out on the ground, pushed my brother out, and told me to get out. And he took our money, and he gave us his money, and he drove away. And we made a lot of money, though, on that deal.
Well, at least he didn't have to do that. I mean, he didn't have to give you anything. He could have just taken your money and your clothes, too, because, you know, the clothes are, you know, a hot item on the black market, and he could have just killed you or just left you on the side of the road. So that was...
That's true.
Well, there you go. That's a pot. I always look for the positive. So there you go. Now, you were stowaways across the Mediterranean Sea. How did you become a stowaway?
Well, we hitchhiked through Europe, and we got to Sicily, took a ship to Sicily. Then we had this deadline to make to get to the port of Trapani in Sicily to go to Africa. And so we're hitchhiking really hard across Sicily around the coastline. We get to Trapani to the shipyard. We never talked about it, actually. We get to the shipyard, and they have this little room there for customs to stamp our passport, let us exit. There's another area to buy your ticket. Well, we skipped buying the ticket. We went to the room to get our customs, our passport stamped, and then we walked down to the shipyard without buying a ticket. My brother and I just started walking, kind of made eye contact, and let's walk. So we walked down to the shipyard, and the ship was just pulling out. We just made it in time. And there's a whole group of people there, a lot of traders with big bags and sacks, you know, of different things they'd bought, and they were arguing with the custom official about something, causing a commotion. So my brother and I just kept walking. We walked around, kind of around the crowd and kind of blended in. There was a couple people going on the boat. We followed them on the boat across the plank, and there was a shipman there on the boat, but he didn't stop us. And then we got onto the boat, and then we tried to kind of hide and stay away from any kind of officials on the boat. And the boat pulled out of the harbor. But then after we're on the boat, we're going across the sea. About an hour later, the official I saw in the customs building was on the ship, and he knew I did not buy a ticket. And I was not trying to make eye contact with anybody, but I looked up by chance, and he's walking right towards me. I made eye contact.
Oh, no.
When I made eye contact, I could see a little flicker of recognition. But he walked right past me. He never asked me for a ticket. And I've always thought that he let me on that ship, that he could have caught me, could have nailed me.
Wow.
If he did.
Wow. Wow. So when the guy let you out in that little town, what
yes.
did you do in this little town? Was this before you got on the ship? Or what did you do in the little town?
This is after the ship. This is in the Sahara.
Oh.
The little town was just a little speck of a town. I mean, they had a little yard there, a little well, a few clay houses, and they had never seen foreigners, especially Americans, across that whole trip across the Sahara, or the route we took. So we walked out into the town. At first, we worried about the soldier. He might come back for us after we let us out of the car. So we're looking for a place to hide, but there's no place to hide. You can see the whole town in just 5 seconds. We're standing on the street deciding what to do, and one of the doors opened, a little clay building, and this old Algerian man with a beard and the robes walks right over to us, makes eye contact, and gestures, do we want to sleep? With his hands, like under his head. And we said, yes, yes, well, thank you. And he took us to his room and let us sleep in his room for about 6 hours. Then we got up, got back in the village, and now the other villagers saw these two Americans in their village, and everybody comes out. They want to touch us. They want to shake our hands. They follow us around. But they are very, very kind to us, the villagers. And
wow.
The whole trip across the Sahara, it'd be one little village, you drive maybe 110 miles, another little village, all desert, and another 100 miles village. We did that all across the Sahara there, and every village we came to, they had never seen, you know, and I never saw Americans before, and this was before any kind of cell phones, they had no movies, TVs, anything, but they were very, very kind to us.
What decade are we talking, just to kind of get a visual, the 70s?
Yeah, this would be actually was in 79, the end of 79. I returned January 2nd of, or January 3rd, I think, of 80.
So during this adventure, was it all one big adventure where that included the 50 countries?
I took many, many different trips. I took a 110-day trip through Asia, 10 countries in Asia. I took the Iron Curtain, Europe. This was just one trip I took.
Oh my gosh. So does this, does your book, Traveling Man Across the Sahara and Beyond, does it include not only your adventures in the Sahara, but also the 50 countries we hear about? So what does the book, just to kind of encapsulate the book, what exactly, if we buy the book, what can we expect to read about?
Okay, this trip is one trip. It's about a 40-day adventure, starting in London through Western Europe, across the Mediterranean Sea to Northern Africa, then 1,000 miles across the Sahara Desert, through the war zone, past the post-sale guerrillas. We run out of money. We get to Gibraltar, take a ship to Gibraltar, and then from Gibraltar back to England. So it's England across Western Europe, Northern Africa, back to England. It was about 40 days, 3,000 miles, and we had 4 crossings by ship.
Wow.
And, very, very cheaply.
What was the most stressful situation that you alone or you and your brother faced on your travels?
Good question. There are really probably two that stand out. One is when we got blocked by the Polisila guerrillas. We're, you know, hitchhiking from village to village across the Sahara. We finally reached one village. We kept hearing these warnings, you must go back, must go back. Finally, at one village, nobody would give us a ride further. And they told us, the Apollo-Seller guerrillas control the road. Anything going through here is supplies for the soldiers. No civilians allowed, especially a couple of Americans. So we were so desperate, we didn't have enough money to go back the way we came. We had to keep going forward. So we met some Arab men in the street, and this is all, we couldn't talk with them, but through drawings, you know, and body language, we told them we needed to get a ride past the Polisario guerrillas. So these two men took us to this little cafe, and we met this guy. I call him Scarface in the book. He had this, he's some kind of smuggler or something. He had a real evil-looking scar down the side of his throat, and he talked to him about taking us through the, hiding us through the checkpoint with the guerrillas. So we negotiate with him, long negotiation, back and forth, back and forth. We agree to pay him $15, which is a lot of money for us at the time. And I write 15 on my hand, 1, 5, and I put a dollar sign. I make him shake my hand, yes, this is the agreement, $15. And he put us in his truck with his partner, starts leaving that village. Now we drive out in the Sahara. It gets really rough and rocky on the road. We drive a few hours, and he pulls off behind this little sand hill. There's nothing out there, just all desert. He takes us to the back of the truck, pulls up this tarp he has with rope, and he points for us to get into the back of the truck and hide. There's a bunch of military boots and uniform stuff back there. He hides us way under all the clothes, puts the clothes on top of us, the tarp, ties the tarp, and now he's driving to the guerrilla checkpoint. So I'm in the back of that truck with my brother. We're just sweating. We know we're going to the border post. They find us there. We don't know what they'll do with us, you know, the guerrillas at the checkpoint. And anyways, he got us through that checkpoint. We never really trusted him, but he got us through the checkpoint. Then he ripped us off. He charged us $50 for the ride.
Instead of 15, you had to pay 50 for the strike. Hey, $50 is worth your life, so that was a good deal
exactly.
You got, too. Now, what do you feel from all of your travels? What do you feel was your greatest achievement from all of your travels? What was the greatest achievement you made?
Interesting. I would say just probably actually doing it. You know, because I tell people stories when I came back at different times about my travels, and everybody always told me, I want to do that. I like to do that. But very few people ever just actually do it. You know, and I think just actually going and doing it, especially at a young age, and kind of following my passion. You know, I had this passion to travel. I knew the world was a big place back then. I wanted to see and explore and meet people in different cultures. And I did it. I just went and did it. And it was very, very difficult. And I'd go to school. I'd go, semester finished, I'd take off traveling in England from Oxford. Run out of money, I'd fly home standby, go to work in my hometown, this little restaurant. I'd work 25 days or 26 days, however long I had, save my money, go back to school, then travel, come home, work, school, travel, work. I did that for 3 years, and I just did it. You know, I didn't talk about it, I did it. So I'm kind of proud of that, just that I actually did it.
You are an adventurer and a thrill seeker for sure. Now, think back, was there a particular moment or a particular trip or a travel moment in your life that changed you or impacted your what was to become your writing?
There were things that happened. You know, one was in the Sahara there with the people I met. I met, you know, people from such diverse backgrounds, and sometimes they looked very fierce or very dangerous or very different from me. But they'd often turn out to be very kind and very accepting. And kind of from I learned that is, you know, is with people, is that people's exterior, whatever color they are, whatever the way they might dress or the culture, they're really basically the same, most people. You know, and with my writing, it's always kind of kept, I've always kind of had that in the back of my mind. Before I traveled, I'd often make kind of assumptions about people. I saw a guy with a long beard and maybe had scraggly clothes or something. I think, that guy's kind of a bum. He's not working. Well, maybe he's not. Maybe he's doing some other situation. I try to learn about their character before I made any kind of judgment of somebody. And also, too, is reading people. When I travel, it's very important to read people. Somebody's a danger or not a danger to me. And every time I enter a room, a hotel, a lobby, someplace, I always scan the room. Who's in the room? Where the people are? Who looks like possible danger to me? And get away from that as soon as possible. Just move myself away from that. And those kind of habits I had, I think they came through in the book as well with my writing, you know, what I learned on the road.
Why... if someone's listening and they're on the, they're teetering, well, should I buy the book? Should I not? Why do you feel you could personally recommend the book? What is it that you feel would be interesting to the masses about your book?
Okay, sure. First of all, it's just a great story. I didn't create the story. I don't think I'm imaginative enough to think of the story and the things that happened. So it's just a really great story. I mean, there's a lot of humor. There's some danger. There's a lot about Muslim culture. I experienced Muslim culture at the most natural form of it. There's things about different cultures and places. So, and the story itself kind of has this underlying tension as we get further through the Sahara, get more and more desperate, run out of money. The tension builds until the final minute of the story, the very last minute, and I'm down to $11 getting back from the kindness of a stranger. It's kind of like a movie. So I think the story itself is just a really interesting story. It's not a typical travel book where I went and had this great meal and I saw this beautiful museum. And it's more of an interesting, exciting story that people enjoy. And then second, I think also for young people, it's a little bit motivational. You know, I have some life lessons, things I learned, travel safety, following your dreams, doing what you got to do. Life lessons that I learned along that trip as a young man that I think other people could apply to their life, you know, for them. So,
So you consider yourself a travel writer, correct? So mm-hmm. We're going to move into the career advice portion of the show.
Sure.
So I'm going to start asking you to help our audience who may have a desire to become a travel writer. So if they're a young kid and they're thinking about it, can you describe the daily things that a travel writer does? This is a multi-hyphenated question. Okay, so can you describe the daily things that a travel writer does, what the work entails, and what is a typical work week like for a travel writer?
Okay, for me, you know, my experience I know from is number one is before I started kind of organizing my material. This happened a long time ago, but I had a very detailed journal. I had photos. I had postcards. It gave me specific timeline and specific events and things that happened. So I organized that first, wrote a basic outline of the story, and then I picked a starting date. I didn't start the story in London at the first day. I started waking up Christmas morning in the middle of Sahara at a Bedouin camp, lost. And then I go back to the start of the story. And I use that as kind of like an intriguing technique to capture attention quickly. When you write a book, you have to get the reader's interest quite quickly. You can't build over time, usually. So I think that helped was that technique of getting the reader interested. What's going to happen? Well, he wakes up, he's in the Sahara, he has no money. And then that was one thing. Second thing, too, is discipline. You know, when I wrote the book, it took me about 18 months, and I wrote almost every day. I write anywhere from 1 to 5 hours. But I just made it a point to try to always write. Because if I stopped, I know where to stop for 2 or 3 weeks. If I just didn't keep at it, you know. So being consistent was very important for me as well with writing the book. And then I wrote 540 pages originally. And then editing it down to 350 pages was very difficult. It was more difficult for me doing the editing than it was for the writing.
And what education or skills would you feel are absolutely necessary to be a travel writer?
Well, for a travel writer, one is the experience. You need to get out there and actually travel. And I suggest, you know, traveling as natural as you can, not taking a tour. It depends on what type of book you're writing, but trying to really learn about the culture and the people, the feel of the country, the smells, so you can really write something that's based in reality. So experiencing as much as you can with your traveling, I think, is very important. Also, for me, what I did is I love to read. I read a lot of different books. I read different travel writers and all different types of books. And when I read, though, I'd always be aware of vocabulary, phrases. Wow, that's an interesting word. Maybe I could use it. I'd write it down and keep that, or some kind of phrase or something that might apply to a situation I have in my book. So I did a lot of reading of other people's works as well, looking for dialogue, how they wrote their dialogue, the vocabulary they used, how they set up a scene. And that was also quite helpful for me with my writing.
And what do you feel is a common misconception that people have about what people do as travel writers?
Well, I think the misconception might be is that it's kind of like, which a lot of books are, oh, you take this nice trip and you go and you find this delicious food and you recommend this restaurant and you see this beautiful work of art. My book is very different. My book kind of reads like a James Patterson type of story. I think the story is what really makes my book exceptional because it's just a great story. You know, it's not my story. It's just what I experienced. I didn't think of the story. It's just what I experienced. So I think that was really very important for my book anyways.
Mm-hmm. And what was it that first trip that you took that made you decide to become a travel writer with somebody who constantly said, you got to write a book, you got to write a book? Because I, based on what I'm hearing, not only should you write a book, I think you should turn it into a screenplay because it sounds like it could be a fascinating movie as well. Have you ever thought about that? And, you know.
Yeah, I have. I've been getting a lot of feedback towards that, and I think it would. It lends itself because, like I said, you have this underlying tension. You have this two brothers on the road, the interplay between them, the life lessons. But then this tension just builds and builds and gets more and more desperate, more obstacles, and it just peaks. It just goes down to the final few minutes at that airport. Our brother's gone. I'm standing there with $11, 19 years old, 1,000 miles away from England. And how do I get back? And it just, I think that it lends itself to a movie. It's very much like a movie.
Absolutely. I'm like seeing the movie in my mind right now. So get working on that, my darling. Now, why do you think, I personally think it's so important to see the world when you're young. There are pros and cons to that. I mean, you can be young and naive and get taken. But then again, if you don't do it when you're young, you might not get an opportunity when you're older because you get stuck in life. So why do you think it's important for young people, especially college students, to see the world?
I think it's a great learning experience. You know, for myself, I had a very good formal education. I studied overseas study at Oxford. I have a degree from George Washington University. But I learned as much from my travel experiences as I did from my formal learning. I learned about making decisions. I learned about earning money, the value of money, using money. Because for me, when I traveled, $1 was a lot of money. I would walk 2 or 3 miles rather than spend a dollar. So about money, you learn about people. I learned about all different kinds of people. I learned about following my gut instinct, which I still try to do. So it was a great, great learning experience for me in terms of the travel, things that I learned about cultures and different places. And so I think for young people, if they have a chance, you know, it's not just kind of really wasting your time. You can learn a lot from it when you do travel.
Yeah. And what destinations, just give me, I don't know, three to five, whatever you feel. Give me three to five destinations that you personally recommend for young travelers to be an absolute must-see today, not, you know, back then, because it's a whole different world today. There are some places you definitely don't want to recommend that people go, period, especially young people. What are three to five that you recommend today?
Well, for me, I'd recommend, number one is also England. I lived there 3 years, like a second home to me. You know, our country is kind of founded on English principles, people coming from England. There's so much history there and the architecture, the people. I think it's a great experience for Americans, kind of our cousins. We call them our cousins, you know, Brits. So I think England would be a great place to go. In Asia, I lived in Asia for about 18 years. Thailand is kind of a different type of travel, but for a young person, you got the beautiful beaches, it's very cheap, you can live in a cabana on the beach and, you know, have this wonderful lifestyle while you're there, very comfortable, very relaxed. I recommend Thailand for young people. It's kind of just a different type of travel. But I would also recommend maybe nowadays is Eastern Europe. I traveled Eastern Europe when it was communist. Now it's open and free. And
Prague.
There's so much history there.
Prague, right? My dream is to go to Prague. Is that somewhere you'd recommend going?
Yeah, I sure would. I sure would. Yeah, I was there a long time ago.
Is it dangerous, though? I hear going to Eastern Europe is dangerous these days. But I would say it's just as dangerous to go to the Middle East. I mean, How do you know if it's going to be dangerous? You know, I don't know how you determine where you're supposed to not go.
So, I think one thing is you can, like, on the internet, is find sources on the internet where people have traveled, their comments. You can also go to the U.S. government advisory, what advisory they give for traveling, and then read the news, follow the news, because things change quite quickly sometimes.
That's true. I hate the news, but you got to read the news before you go traveling. Now, we've got like 10 minutes to go, and I want to just get some more career advice in there, but what are some of your top tips or travel advice for travelers who are looking to travel alone? Because it's very different traveling alone than with a person. Sure. So give us some tips on that.
Okay, one is safety first. Always safety first. Whatever you're doing, always think in terms of safety. One thing is when you travel alone, I call what they call situational awareness in the military. Whenever you're going somewhere, you're always aware of your situation. Who's around you, where you are, what type of dangers might be around you. I used to sometimes see people traveling, and they got their big map open. They're walking down the street looking at the map. They got money hanging out of their pockets, you know. You just make yourself a target.
Mm-hmm.
So always situational awareness. You're always aware of who's around you, where you have a point of escape. I need to leave this area. How do I leave this area? Is number one for safety. A second thing is, like with your money, one thing is be careful of being shortchanged. Shortchanged is where you go into a bank or exchange office, you give them some money, they give you the exchange money in return. You walk away, you start counting your money, oh, wow, I'm way short, they didn't give me enough money. You go back to the counter, they don't give you your money back.
Right.
Or you buy some, you pay a lot of money, you buy something in a nice store, they give your change back, you walk away, oh. Then give me my correct change back. Always count your money before you leave where you're at. If you exchange at a bank, always sit there and count your money. If you're at a store, always count your money right before you leave. I was shortchanged probably 7 or 8 times, and it happened in South Korea, it happened in America, it happened in Thailand, many different places. So that's one thing with your money. Another thing for personal safety, especially when you're alone, is whenever you go into a hotel room, and this could be if you're a real nice travel, an upscale traveler like I was, a backpacker. When you go into your room, I always leave the door open. I walk into the room, I check under the bed, I check in the closet, check in the bathroom. I make sure nobody is in the room before I fully enter the room. One friend of mine, a flight stewardess, this happened in America, nice hotel. She came into her room, put her bag down, walked in the bathroom, and there was a man hiding under her bed, tried to assault her. You know, so I, and I had experienced myself in my book. There's a story about on a train, something like that happened. So I always check your room before you enter. Everything's secure. And another thing, a scam I've come across with your money, probably 5 or 6 times. This is in your room, like your hotel room. There's a cabinet, or there's maybe a closet with a drawer to put your money in, your valuables. Always check the back wall to make sure it's not a fake wall. What happens is you get in your hotel, they got this cabinet there, you open it up, you put your money, your valuables in it, you close it, you go about your business, you come back, your money's gone. You're like, how did somebody get in my room? They never got in your room. They're in the next room next door. They have a fake back wall. They pull down, they reach into your cabinet, take your valuables out, put the wall back up, and your money's gone.
Oh,
I also found that in a very upscale health club, the locker at health club. You have that shelf to put your money on the locker. So I put my things in the locker. I had a bad feeling. I've always known this. So I pressed the back wall. It was a fake wall. I'm sure the owner of that health club was every day taking money out of lockers. And people are like, wow, how does somebody get in my locker? They never did. They're in the next aisle over behind the locker. They reached in and take the money out.
Now, most hotels you go into, they have safes now. Is that okay to have a safe? Is that safe to have a safe?
Yeah, and I always get a receipt. Wherever you put in the safe, you get a receipt, something written, so you have a document of it.
Oh, my Lord.
But
now,
those are safe, yeah.
What do you feel are some must-have items that you have to pack every time you take a trip, other than the obvious things, like something that people wouldn't think about?
One thing is matches, not so much for lighting, but for smells. When you're in a bad-smelling area, just light a couple matches, and it kills the smell.
Oh, yeah, the sulfur. Would... We know what you're talking about, honey, especially in the bathroom, right?
Yeah, I was in some bad bathrooms on those trips.
Yes.
So I recommend that. I recommend, too, as far as, like, for your passport or your money, what I took for a lot of my travels was this wallet. It was a big wallet, and I could seal it with a zipper, and it was chained to my belt. So I put it in my back pocket, but it was chained to my belt, so I could never leave it behind. If I put it on the side and got up, it would be dangling on the belt. And I had two times somebody took it out of my pocket, was trying to take it away from me, and they told me it was on my belt.
That's like when they used to bury people. They would have the bell outside of the grave, and they would keep it there. And if you were alive, that you would pull it, and then they would, like, unearth you. Yeah, that's what they used to do. They used to, because they didn't have any way of telling back in the day, back in the old days. Sometimes they would just say, oh, he's dead, and they'd bury people, and then they'd be alive. So what they did was they started tying a string around people's fingers, and then if you were buried alive, you would pull the string, and then, they would have someone that would sit there in a chair for a couple days. That was like their whole job.
Wow, that's really interesting. I never heard that. Very, very interesting.
Yeah, that's a good idea with the bell. Now, I don't know if you have one, but I have what's called a life list or a bucket list. So what are some destinations that are still on the list, and are you going to travel anymore, or is there another book in our future? Or
I have this another book would be the trip behind the Iron Curtain, because that was also just so unique, and very few Americans that have ever done that during the Cold War. So that'd be another book that I'd like to write. And then also, too, as far as a place to go, I've always wanted to go to India. I've had friends who've gone there. It's such extreme wealth and poverty and the different languages. And but I've never made it to India yet. That's one of my goals for travel.
Well, put it on your bucket list, Dennis. You have to put it on your bucket list. Now, I want to talk, obviously, if somebody wants to hear about your amazing adventures, and I am going to press you to really start working on a screenplay, because I think that your story, there's definitely a movie involved. I mean, my God, with all the movies they're making today, there is a definite... So please start working on that. But for people, I want people to buy your book, because it's a very fascinating book. It has so many adventures. It's a good read. I'm sure if Oprah read your book, it would be on her book list. So for us to find it, where do we go? Is it on Amazon? Tell us where to go to buy your book, Dennis.
Sure. The easiest place is Amazon.com. You can buy it worldwide, and they'll deliver within two or three days. So Amazon.com, you can just type in my name, Dennis Feely, F-E-E-H-E-L-E-Y, or Traveling Man Across the Sahara and Beyond. It'll come right up. You can also buy it on BarnesandNoble.com and most internet sites. But Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com are the most popular sites. But it's worldwide, and worldwide distribution.
Right. And if you want to check out Dennis's website, you want to go to dfaheely. Now, this is a long website. I'm going to try it, but I own a website design company. You're going to have to contact me, and I'm going to have to redo your website and give you a short website name. But it's dfaheely, dfaheely.wix.com/traveling, TRAVELIN1. So, but if somebody Googles you and just types Dennis D. Fahili, they should find you, right?
Yes, they would. They can see some of the articles that written about me and about the book and the distribution and so forth. Yes.
So what are some hot projects? We're going to end in 1 minute, but what are some things that we need to know about Dennis of events or projects coming up in the future?
Well, I'll be on a TV show in Santa Barbara on Thursday. Is Around the World Travel is the show. Around the World Travel on Thursday for a TV appearance. And then I have
just so people can tune in. Where can we go to find out when to view it? What's the station called? Is there a website?
Let's see, ITV, on the internet, ITV. It's an internet program based in Santa Barbara.
The website is ITV, just an I, and then TV.com.
Yes, and then it's around the world travel. I don't know if you need that or not.
And what time are you going to be on that so we can tune in?
I'll be on the show. I believe it's about 10 o'clock in the morning this Thursday, February 12th. And they'll put it up on the website. It'll be up there. You can go back and see it any time as well.
Okay.
Type in the date, February 12th.
What else you got going on?
I'll be giving a speech at Brother Rice High School in Michigan. It's also upcoming right now. Those are the two things I have on the schedule
right
now.
Is that open to the public, or you have to be
No, it's not.
Oh, darn it.
Yes,
all right, well, we can watch you this Thursday. And, Dennis, I just, again, please, please consider writing a screenplay for this. This is a movie. I'm telling you, I'm in the entertainment business. I know.
Yeah.
When there's a great idea for a movie, and I'm telling you, that is an idea. So get working on that, and then come back on the show so we can announce you're going into development for the movie. We have to have you.
Well,
back.
I appreciate it very much.
All right.
I appreciate it very much. I'll talk to you further about that.
Well,
that's great idea,
Dennis. Thank you for coming on. Say goodbye to your fans.
Okay. Yeah, I want to thank everybody very much, and thank you very much, Priscilla. I greatly enjoyed it, and you had some very good questions. Great questions.
Oh, thank you. Well, you had some very good answers, so we're a complete match. All right, come back on the show, Dennis. Get in touch with me. We're going to have you come back. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Go to Dennis's website, dfahili.wix.com. Type in Travelant. Buy his book on Amazon.com. It is called... Go ahead, Dennis. Give it the last
traveling plug. Traveling man across the Sahara and beyond.
There you go, everybody. Go buy the book. Thank you for tuning in, everybody. Thank you, Dennis. We'll see you next week on Question Reality. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Yep.
You're listening to Question Reality with Priscilla Leona right here on LA Talk Radio.